solving one problem can cause another. And we bring you an example of that truism today from the world of agricultural biotechnology. NPR's Joe Palca has this example of the law of unintended consequences.
When the biotech world was young, scientists and regulators struggled with a problem. They could put things called transgenes into seeds that would give crop plants desirable properties, such as resistance to disease. But ecologists worried what would happen if these transgenes spread from cultivated plants to their wild neighbors growing nearby.
People are concerned that when the transgene escapes into the wild populations, that it will provide a fitness advantage.
That's Andrew Stevenson. He's a plant ecologist at Penn State. A fitness advantage means the wild plants with this advantageous transgene might grow out of control, mucking up the ecosystem. Stevenson studies a wild squash plant called the Texas gourd.
The fruits are about the size of a baseball to the size of a softball, and they're round or slightly pear-shaped.
Tastes terrible. It shows up throughout the American Southwest and Mexico. Stevenson wanted to know what would happen when his wild gourd picked up a transgene that's used in cultivated squash to protect the crop from plant viruses. So he purposely created a strain of Texas gourd with the transgene and planted it next to the same gourd that didn't have the transgene. Then he waited for spring when aphids would bring a plant virus to the field.
As the virus spread through our field, it only affected the Texas gourd.
That is, the gourd without the transgene. As they report in the journal PNAS, at first, it looked like what scientists feared was happening. The plants that had the transgene did have that fitness advantage. They stayed healthy while their unmodified cousins got sick. But then something strange happened. After the aphids arrived in the field, along came another pest, the cucumber beetle. The beetles carry a different plant disease, not a virus, but a bacteria.
And these bacteria secrete an exopolysaccharide, like a snot-like stuff.
And when the beetles eat the gourd's leaves and flowers, this snot-like stuff gets into the plant's plumbing, first causing the leaves to wilt and ultimately killing the plant. But here's the funny thing. The cucumber beetle will eat plants that are sick with a virus.
But they tend not to like them, so they fly off to someplace else.
And that someplace else is the healthy plant, protected from the virus by the transgene. So,
as the virus spreads through the susceptible plants in the field, the beetles become increasingly concentrated onto the healthy transgenic plants.
Yes, the plants are protected from the virus, but that makes them more vulnerable to the bacteria. Stevenson says no one suspected that would happen.
And these indirect ecological effects were not predictable based on any sort of laboratory study.
Now, in this particular case, the unintended consequences aren't bad. The wild gourd apparently won't grow out of control. But Norman Elstrand says that's not the point. Elstrand is a plant geneticist at the University of California, Riverside.
We know the transgenes sometimes end up giving us unexpected effects. And when you do an experiment like Stevenson's group did, you see how complicated ecology actually is.
Because people basically say, oh, never thought of that.
Exactly.
In other words, you don't know what you don't know. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a reminder this morning of just how complicated it can be to fight global warming. Anti-global warming rules now in effect may actually encourage people to cut down forests. That news comes just as we prepare for a lot of talk about climate change. The Senate is debating an energy bill next week, and in December, Copenhagen will host a global conference on climate. Officials may have to give thought to a finding in today's Science magazine. It focuses on biofuels, which are made from plants. Current laws on biofuels have unintended consequences, which in turn make climate change worse. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
If you burn ethanol from corn in your car, the government doesn't count the carbon dioxide that comes out the tailpipe as an actual carbon emission. That's because they figure the corn plant originally took that carbon dioxide out of the air, so you're just putting it back. But 13 prominent scientists point out in Science magazine that's bad logic when it comes to many types of biofuels. Author Tim Searchinger is from Princeton University, and he offers an extreme example to make the point.
Even if you were to cut down the world's forests and turn them into a parking lot and take the wood and put it in a boiler, which obviously releases enormous amounts of carbon in the trees, that is treated as a pure way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And that's obviously an error.
And that error isn't trivial. It's now enshrined in European law as well as the Kyoto Climate Treaty.
The problem is that when the world agreed to a treaty that limited the amount of carbon that goes up the smokestack, they didn't agree to limit the amount of carbon released by cutting down trees.
Searchinger explains that in an effort to avoid double counting carbon emissions, the treaty negotiators ended up with a system that never counts them at all. And he says the climate bill that passed the U.S. House of Representatives earlier this year makes basically the same error, though at the moment the Senate bill does have forest safeguards in place. As a result of this accounting error, countries trying to reduce their carbon emissions actually have an incentive to cut down forests and burn them up, or replant the area with biofuels crops. In fact, Searchinger says power plants in Northern Europe are starting to chip up wood and burn it for energy in the name of reducing emissions.
The fundamental effect of this flaw is to make forests worth more dead than alive.
This spring, another report in Science magazine pondered what would happen in the coming decades if biofuels carbon was never counted as an emission. Jay Edmonds at the Pacific Northwest National Lab says they calculated that almost all the world's forests would be chopped down by the middle of this century.
You can't actually imagine this thing going on like this with no one noticing and no one stepping in to intervene, but the numerical experiment is instructive in that it takes the phenomena into sharp relief.
The good news is it's very easily fixable.
Again, Tim Searchinger. He says nations simply need to count all carbon dioxide coming out of tailpipes and smokestacks, regardless of the source. Then, if the source of the biofuel was a destructive one, like deforestation, there would be no carbon emissions credit. But if it was from a good source, like plants grown on previously barren land, that would earn a carbon credit.
So there are substantial amounts of bioenergy we can make that do give us greenhouse gas benefits. What we don't want to do is create a false and perverse incentive simply to go clear the world's forests.
Whether this new accounting scheme would affect the domestic biofuels industry is debatable. Bob Dineen, president of the Renewable Fuels Association, says it shouldn't matter.
Some of the points that have been made in the paper today we agree with. You should never, under any circumstance, tear down a forest for the growing of a biofuel.
But some scientists argue that the domestic biofuels industry does indirectly lead to deforestation in the tropics by raising the global price of corn and encouraging farmers in South America to clear land to plant grain. Jay Edmonds from the Pacific Northwest National Lab says if we could place a cash value on preserving forests, that ends up being good for the atmosphere.
You end up not producing quite as much biofuel, but then you don't need as much because you don't have to make up for the deforestation.
The real challenge now, Edmonds says, is figuring out how to put a new carbon accounting system into practice. Richard Harris, NPR News.
One problem of accounting for carbon is trying to figure out how much carbon goes into forests and comes out again. That's important because forests could become carbon banks, as they're called, storing carbon and keeping it out of the atmosphere. The legislation pending in Congress would pay people to grow trees, but as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, carbon banking is a tricky business.
The idea is simple. Grow more forests or save existing ones, and you curb climate change. Growing trees suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and store it in wood and roots. Dead or burned trees release CO2 into the air. Forests have become a great green hope for curbing global warming. For one thing, growing them is usually cheaper than reducing emissions from factories and power plants. The rub is in the accounting. How much carbon will forests store and for how long? Let's say you let a forest grow unchecked. That puts a lot of carbon in the bank. But western U.S. forests can become tinderboxes. Here's forest ecologist Matthew Herto from Northern Arizona University.
Without regular surface fire, the litter, branches, coarse woody debris build up over time. And then when fire does occur, end up releasing more energy and carbon.
Frequent small fires keep the woody debris down. That's why foresters regularly start them on purpose to keep those huge fires from happening later on. But any fire puts CO2 into the air. So do frequent small fires put more or less carbon into the atmosphere than the occasional massive fire?
You know, that is really a question that we're looking for the answer to right now.
Herto's research in the Sierra Nevada mountains suggests that one way to keep fires to a minimum and still store lots of carbon is to return those forests to what they were 150 years ago, large trees growing in patches, lots of space between them, and fewer small trees. But no one knows for sure. Forests may also grow differently in the future. It's already warmer, and climate scientists say it will keep getting warmer. Gregory Latta is a forest economist at Oregon State University who studied how northwestern forests might be affected by warming. In some places, warming could slow growth, and that means less carbon in the bank.
At the lower elevations, they have moisture, and as you crank up the temperature in the growing season, that moisture evaporates, and so it's kind of taking away from them a little bit.
Latta adds that a warmer climate would probably have the opposite effect on higher-altitude forests. They grow faster. In the end, northwestern forests might see overall increases, but that may not apply elsewhere.
So you can't really put this broad brush across the whole area and say, here's the impact of climate change. It's going to really impact different areas depending on what their starting point was.
Then there's another trend to watch, drought. Climate models predict the West will get drier. David Brashears at the University of Arizona says scientists are seeing more dead and dying trees already.
So there's a potential for kind of a double whammy between having warmer temperature and drought, which could trigger fire or tree die-off, and that'll pose a challenge in terms of how much carbon can you store in a system.
Brashears says scientists don't really know yet how forests will store carbon for a potential climate bank, as well as deliver timber, provide a home for wildlife, and not burn up too often. In fact, one of the first experiments to manage a forest carbon bank has already run into trouble. 12 years ago, the Nature Conservancy and the Bolivian government set aside a forest in Bolivia called Noel Kempf Mercado. They closed down sawmills and stopped cutting timber. Experts predicted that over 30 years, they would reduce CO2 from deforestation by 55 million tons. Now, they say, it's more like 5.5 million tons. That's not a failure, though, say experts at the Conservancy. They simply know more now about storing carbon in trees, knowledge they can share with others planning similar carbon banks. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Washington, D.C. has that flailing football team, but it's got a football team. There hasn't been pro football in Los Angeles for 15 years. And this week, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a bill that did away with environmental oversight for a proposed stadium that would return the NFL to the Los Angeles area. As KQED's Rob Schmitz reports, some fear it'll set a disturbing precedent.
Los Angeles hasn't had an NFL team since 1994. That's when the Raiders and Rams left the city because taxpayers refused to pay team owners to build new stadiums. Still, the economic prospects for a team in the nation's second largest television market is a no-brainer. So if taxpayers in LA won't help you build a stadium, what's a poor billionaire to do? The answer? Find a city nearby where hardly anyone lives and where business is king.
We're really a business-friendly city designed that way for business.
David Perez is the mayor of the City of Industry. He walks along a ridge overlooking his city's warehouses and office buildings 20 miles east of Los Angeles. The city doesn't collect business taxes, and factories are allowed to operate 24/7. Only 800 people live here, and they don't mind big new projects coming to town. In other words, if you're a billionaire, this is a perfect place to build a football stadium. But not for industry's neighbors.
We're very concerned that they want to come through, remove our bike lanes, widen our streets, narrow our medians.
Bridget Bierkes from Walnut, the affluent neighboring town that calls itself Little Switzerland.
Game days, we won't be able to leave our homes. We're going to be locked in here.
Bierke and seven others filed a lawsuit to try and stop the project. The complaint took aim at the hasty manner in which billionaire developer Ed Roske assembled the environmental impact report for the stadium. Instead of going through the lengthy process of completing one, Roske instead recycled an old report from a shopping center he wanted to build at the same site, used that, and added a supplement which included the new project.
Personally, I was just so disgusted.
Bierke wasn't alone. The majority of the agencies that signed off on the original report also criticized the move. Lawyers throughout the state said the Citizens Group's lawsuit would probably prevail, which would have forced Roski to draft a new report for the project. Instead of going to court, though, Roski went to Sacramento, where his lobbyists persuaded California's legislature to pass a bill that'll exempt state environmental laws for the project, effectively nullifying the lawsuit.
It's about time that we get a football team back to Los Angeles.
This week, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed the bill. Behind the governor were dozens of workers wearing gleaming white hard hats, all union members, excited at the developer's promise of 18,000 new jobs for a state with the fourth highest unemployment rate in the country. Schwarzenegger addressed the thorny environmental issue by saying it was the citizens group, not the legislature, that was making a mockery of the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA.
It is clear that opponents aren't using CEQA for the sake of the environment, but they're abusing CEQA to stop the project just because they don't like it.
Schwarzenegger praised the project, highlighting the fact that it'll be the first stadium in the country to be certified as having a green building design. The stadium will be built into the hillside and will be powered by solar panels. But many environmentalists aren't swayed. Tina Andolina is legislative director of the Planning and Conservation League. She says throwing out environmental oversight to approve this project is an unprecedented move in state politics, one, she warns, that will return to haunt Californians.
This means that next year we can expect to see big, massive developments up and down the state running to the legislature with high-paid lobbyists asking for exemptions. If you could do it for an NFL stadium, you could do it for anything. It's really, really disheartening.
But it's anything but disheartening for Maria Elena Durazo, who heads L.A. County's AFL-CIO.
More than 30% of the construction union workers are currently unemployed. Brothers and sisters, that's not a recession. That's a crisis. And this stadium, then, is going to bring renewed hope for those families.
But families in San Diego might be left out. That city's football team, the Chargers, seems open to relocate because it wants a new stadium. A state senator representing the region tried unsuccessfully to change the bill to require that any team based at the new stadium come from out of state. After all, said the senator, if LA lures away another California team, there will be no net economic benefit for the Golden State. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Today, climate activists will hold more than 4,000 events around the world. They're trying to draw attention to a number, 350, that they say is key to global warming. So, 350 scuba divers will hold an underwater demonstration in the Maldives. Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians will gather around the Dead Sea to form the numerals 350 with their bodies. And 350 people in Seattle will gather to perform Michael Jackson's Thriller dance together. We're now joined by NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
So what's the deal with this number 350?
Well, 350 comes from an organization that is appropriately enough called 350.org. It's the brainchild of author, activist Bill McKibben. Mm-hmm. And that number relates to the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now, I don't want to overwhelm you with numbers, but let me give you a couple of them. Before the Industrial Revolution, the atmosphere was 280 parts per million. Now, after burning all these fossil fuels, we're up to 390 parts per million. So we've added a lot of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. In fact, these guys argue we've already added too much. And not only do we have to stabilize it, we actually have to bring it down, back down to 350. And that's based on a scientific paper that was written by Jim Hansen, a famous NASA scientist, who basically argued that anything above 350 actually puts the world at one of those tipping points where we might get like melting ice sheets and things like that and have essentially irreversible changes to the planet.
But how does that goal of 350 compare with the climate legislation that's making its way through Congress now or international talks on a climate treaty?
350 is actually much more aggressive. The major international players like the United States and China have actually not been talking so much in terms of parts per million in the atmosphere, but they've come to a fairly remarkable agreement that the Earth should not warm by more than 2 degrees centigrade, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So the question is, how do you get to that number? And there's some science that says there's basically a 50-50 chance that we can still increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by a fair amount, up to maybe 450 parts per million, and we'll still have like a 50-50 chance of staying below that magic 2 degrees change. But it's also possible that that's a 50-50 chance. If you're betting the world, maybe you don't want to, maybe you want to improve your odds. And I think that's what the point that Jim Hansen made in his paper when he said it really should be 350 parts per million.
Now, how hard would it be to achieve those goals, given some of the avenues that are being contemplated now?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people came into this assuming that 450 parts per million would be really, really difficult to achieve. So 350 would be even much harder. And that's because you basically have to rewire the entire global economy. You've got to get rid of coal in the next 20 years entirely, or at least bury the carbon dioxide if you can figure out a way to do that. And there are a number of economic studies that show that you could probably do this without creating ruinous economic problems. But the real problem is that there are winners and losers, and the people who stand to lose, like the coal-burning utilities, of course, are very, very unhappy about this, and they're fighting hard not to change the status quo. So you would have windmill producers who would say, yeah, we would have a huge new market if we weren't competing with coal, but the coal producers saying, we don't want to go this way.
All of these events today, of course, are aimed at attracting the interest of the public, and what's your reading as to how interested the public is in some of these issues right now?
Well, I read a poll this week which suggests that the public is actually losing interest in climate change. In January, the American public ranked addressing global warming as the very bottom of the 20 issues that they care most about. It was number 20. Mm-hmm. And the poll this week by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press found a very sharp drop in the percentage of Americans who say there's, quote, solid evidence the Earth is warming. So actually, it seems as though as the international world is gearing up for the climate talks in Copenhagen and as the Senate mm-hmm. prepares next week to start talking about new climate legislation, the public is saying, maybe not so interested.
What do you attribute that dip in interest to?
That's hard to say, but I think part of it is that throughout the 1990s, the world was getting dramatically warmer. We had a lot of hot summers. We had a mm-hmm. very rapid and noticeable increase. It's not been so much true in the 2000s. And people, I think, say, what's happening to the climate? They sort of put their hand out the window and say, it's not too much hotter than it was last year. And they forget that they can't see what's happening at the North Pole, which is extremely dramatic, and other places around the world. So I think people's perceptions of global warming are determined really by local things that are happening over the period of a couple of years when we really need to be thinking in terms of what the planet's going to look like in a matter of decades.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, thank you.
My pleasure.
And you can see videos, some of the Climate Change 350 events on our blog, npr.org/soapbox. You're listening to NPR News.
President Obama's top envoy on climate change today dashed hopes of a climate change deal between China and the U.S. when Mr. Obama visits that country next month. The two countries account for 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions. The envoy, Todd Stern, who's in China, said there are still major areas of disagreement. This comes as the countries look ahead to a global climate change conference in December in Copenhagen. NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Shanghai.
We're pushing them and they're pushing us, Todd Stern said, summing up the mood between Chinese and U.S. climate change negotiators. Stern said there'll be no agreement on climate change during Obama's trip to China next month. The focus will be on clean energy cooperation and aligning Chinese and American positions ahead of Copenhagen. However, Stern admitted that differences still remain, particularly over U.S. demands for China to cut its greenhouse gas emissions.
They absolutely have to cap their emissions in the sense of having them reduce significantly as compared to where their trend line is. China could make a reduction twice as ambitious as the U.S. is doing, and still that would still involve their emissions going up somewhere from where they are now.
But Beijing is resisting U.S. pressure, arguing it's using other measures. It's already announced a goal of improving energy efficiency by 20% in the 5 years to 2010. It's also planting trees over an area the size of California. Zhou Fenqi from Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences spells out China's line that emission caps would damage its development.
We could not limit the amount of food for a child because a child needs to grow. He needs more than the adult. So we cannot use the caps.
This despite the fact that China is now the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, according to the International Energy Agency. But China likes to point out that its cumulative emissions are a quarter of America's. Huang Renwei, also from the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences.
This situation is not made by China. It's 100 years ago. So the developed country should share more responsibility than China. So the U.S. could not make this as excuse. China should do most responsibility than U.S.
That's why China wants the U.S. to make much larger emission cuts than those pledged. Beijing also wants developed countries to contribute a portion of their GDP, between 0.5 to 1%, to developing countries to help adapt to global warming. And it's keen for more technology transfers. But Todd Stern says China is unlikely to get much financial assistance from the U.S.
There are various kinds of technology cooperation and technology efforts that could include China. I would not think that there would be large amounts of financial assistance going to China as compared to other developing countries just because of China's relatively advanced state of development.
Stern defended U.S. progress, saying President Obama had done more to reduce emissions than anyone in U.S. history. He also noted the U.S. has pledged $80 billion towards clean energy. But young Chinese environmentalists like Sarah Pang are disappointed with what they see as a lack of U.S. leadership on the issue.
They are demanding that we meet their demands, but they're not doing it themselves. I think the U.S. should set an example for the rest of the world.
In the meantime, China's moving fast. Its goal is to produce 15% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. It's already the world's largest producer of solar panels. It will overtake the U.S. as the top manufacturer of wind turbines this year. Todd Stern warns the U.S. must take action.
The competitive danger that we have with China is what will happen if we don't move aggressively into the world of green tech and clean energy, because that's the world of economic development in the 21st century, and the Chinese are starting to move there.
On prospects for a deal in Copenhagen, Stern is hedging his bets. "I think there's a deal to be had," he said, "but that doesn't mean we're going to get it." Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.